The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're looking at the biological impulses that drive humanity's technical achievements. We're joined by journalist Peter Nowick to discuss his book, Sex, Bombs, and Burgers, How War, Porn, and Fast Food Shaped Modern Technology. But first, we're going to talk about another source of technological advancement, space exploration. I'm here with John Zeller. John is a senior majoring in computer science at Oregon State University. He's active in the OSU Robotics Club, where he's currently serving as the team lead for the Mars Rover team. Welcome to the show, John.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you've started a project trying to boost government funding for space projects in the U.S. So tell us about Penny for NASA.
Well, Penny for NASA was a movement that was started kind of in and amongst the community of people that really love space. No one person can really take full credit for it. But what I ended up doing in the time that I came with it, I saw a recording of Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson speaking to the U.S. Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation on a meeting that they were having about the future of the U.S. space program. And Dr. Tyson did not request to be testifying at this meeting, but he was asked to come. So he did. He gave about an 8-minute speech talking about NASA, the benefits of NASA, and the opportunity costs of not funding a program that gives so much economic benefit and cultural and technological and inspirational benefit to not only the United States, but the rest of the world. And one thing that he said at the end of that speech really resonated with me. He said, I'm paraphrasing, of course, be bold. What if we doubled NASA's budget? When you assume that NASA's budget is 10 or 20%. That sounds like a lot, doubling it. But in fact, NASA's budget represents 0.48% of total US spending, which represents about $17.7 billion. And when you double that, it's only 1% of the budget. And that's where the name Penny for NASA comes from. So after watching this video, I went on Twitter and Facebook and I saw hashtag Penny for NASA all over the place. There had been a video put on YouTube that had hashtag Penny for NASA all over it that was trending around 300,000 views. And I wanted to do more than just retweeting or sharing on Facebook. So I purchased the domain name penny4nasa.org. I set up a petition on change.org, and I got the Facebook, Twitter, and Google Plus pages all set up within the evening. After I got it all set up, in the next 48 hours, we're on the Washington Post, and we were getting a lot of attention. Most recently, we released episode 2 of the We Stop Dreaming series that started really moving forward the Penny for NASA name, and we've been getting a lot of attention.
What exactly would increasing the overall spending on NASA to do by the 1% that you're talking about?
Well, let me qualify that statement first. Increasing the budget for NASA is really important. But one thing that we are striving to highlight is the importance of the research that NASA's been able to do already with the funding that they already have. What we don't want to do is give the negative impression that NASA is not able to do amazing research with the funding that they have, because they are, and they have been for a really long time. One of the problems is that they are reaching this point in their history and our collective history as a whole, where NASA's role in space exploration is changing, and it's changing for the better. They are no longer going to be the sole provider of transportation. They're no longer going to be building rockets. They're going to be looking to private industry to do those kinds of things. And a really great example of NASA supporting that was the COTS demonstrations that they paid out money to SpaceX, I think Blue Origin, and a bunch of other organizations that are competing to get a piece of this transportation pie. And they're in this transitional period where they will become closer to something like the FAA, but they will have a huge amount of, they will be doing a lot of scientific research and things that they already do, a lot of R&D, and they won't be building rockets anymore. Like I said, they won't be doing transportation stuff. We need to help NASA through this transitional period. It's such an amazing organization. They've done so much for us economically, technologically, inspirationally. And so many people are doing what they're doing now as scientists, engineers, and technologists because of seeing NASA and what they were doing when they were kids growing up. And without an organization like that, I think that our future has a much bleaker outlook in terms of inspiring individuals to learn these things. And that in itself, I think, is a reason to make sure that NASA is adequately funded and us as a community believe that 1% would not be outrageous.
So I realize it's not about the 1% per se, but is there a particular kind of project that you'd personally like to see NASA working on with that new money?
Personally, I'd like to see NASA continuing to do the projects that it is doing and expanding those projects. I'd like to see more manned missions. I'd like to see more robotic scientific missions, especially to deep space, really looking at Jupiter's moons and things. But that's me personally. I'm not speaking for the organization as a whole or the movement as a whole. And I think that a lot of people have their own ideas of what they was really important to NASA. And actually, us at pennyfornasa.org, we're working on some grassroots ideas for creating some interactivity inside of this campaign, inside of this movement, to really show why do people love NASA? And or more accurately, what does NASA mean to you? And I think that that's different for everybody. And when we launch this new campaign, I think that there's going to be a lot of really awesome answers for that.
Well, since you already gave me a disclaimer, then I can ask, where do you stand on the human explorers versus robot missions debate? And I agree, this has nothing to do with Penny for NASA. I'm just curious.
Right. Well, it's pretty obvious that scientific robotic missions are more economically dependable, right? That you can, a manned mission, I'm not sure the exact numbers, but it's something like 10 times as expensive. And there's a lot that you have to bring along. You have to bring along all of your oxygen, all of your food. You have to be able to get back, things like that. Robots don't care, right? You bring out a robot, they don't need to necessarily be all that comfortable. They don't need to come home. They don't whine when you don't feed them, and things like that. The real benefit of having human exploration, in my opinion, is there's a few reasons, and I'll touch on a couple of those. One is, robots and computers are not to the level where they can make serendipitous discoveries. A lot of really amazing scientific discoveries have been made on accident, and robots just cannot do that. They're designed to do one thing, they'll figure that thing out, and if something amazing is happening right next to them, they'll never know, and they're not going to give you that information because they were not programmed to do that. So that's one reason. The next reason is there is a huge amount of inspirational value put in manned exploration. People, me included, a lot of scientists and engineers as well, got into their fields because they saw man go to the moon. They saw constant shuttle missions, the servicing of a Hubble, images being beamed back from that, people going out into this vast universe and exploring. And I think that really ignites the imagination of everyone. And I think without having a manned component to the space program, we would lose out on a lot of that. Robotic missions have a lot more economic value in the short term because they're cheaper and you can get a lot out of them. But who's to say that if you had no manned program at all, that 10 years down the road, you would not have enough scientists and engineers to complete the things that you would like to do as a society.
Well, you mentioned the economy, and I'm wondering, what would you say to those people who think that maybe the money that we would spend on space exploration might be better spent on Earth?
Sure. There's always that argument. There are a lot of really great programs that money goes towards. There are also a lot of things there are a lot of places that money could come from with certain programs that are ending and certain situations that we are leaving that free up funds. Those funds are going to go somewhere. And we think that an amazing program such as NASA should probably at least be considered for things like that.
So how can people help?
We'd like people to go to our website, penny4nasa.org. That's the number 4. We need you to sign the petition. There's links on the website to do that. If you have the money to do so, we'd like you to donate. A dollar or more helps. Share our message. Put it on Facebook. Put it on Twitter. Put it on Google+. Email it to all of your loved ones. And then get involved. We're going to be posting more information online. We're hosting another campaign soon that we're calling #SpaceSwag. And those are going to be weekly contests in which we ask our community to do something. It may be submitting pictures or videos. It may be something completely different. And at the end of each week, we're going to pick a winner. And that winner gets a bag of space swag. And it'll be full of Penny for NASA gear.
You rule, sir.
Thank you.
Really, this is a great idea.
Well, we're working pretty hard on it. We have a pretty good team put together. And we're excited to try to see if we can make some waves.
Well, we're very happy to get the word out. So best of luck.
Thank you.
You'll find a link to pennyfornasa.org on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with Peter Nowick, author of Sex, Bombs, and Burgers, How War, Porn, and Fast Food Shaped Modern Technology, after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at speak73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm here today with Peter Nowick, freelance journalist, syndicated blogger, and best-selling author based in Toronto. His work regularly appears in the Globe and Mail, Maclean's, and Canadian business magazines, while his personal blog is at wordsbynowick.com. We're going to be talking about his new book, or his not new book, Sex, Bombs, and Burgers, How War, Porn, and Fast Food Created Technology as We Know It. Thanks for being here, Peter.
Yeah, no problem.
So your book is based on an interesting premise, sir. Tell us about it.
Well, it's the story I enjoy telling people is that it kind of all started with Paris Hilton. It was a few years ago. The video that apparently made her famous was making its rounds on the internet, and this is the video. It was, of course, the sex video. She had filmed herself having sex with her boyfriend at the time in some hotel room, and the thing that got me interested in the video, not believe it or not, it wasn't the actual sex. It was the fact that it was actually green, so it was filmed in night vision. So I remember coming across it online and thinking, well, where have I seen this sort of green stuff before? And then eventually it hit me that it was back in the early 90s, back when the U.S. was invading or liberating Kuwait from Iraq,
right,
in the Gulf War. And I don't know if you remember, but all the images of that on CNN, it was always this, you know, nighttime shelling going on, and it was all in green, so that was also in night vision. So that kind of got me thinking to how this military technology that technologies that we usually see the military deploy first, sooner or later eventually end up coming into the consumer world. And in this particular case, it was an interesting link to I guess pornography, because it was it's military technology that was used to create porn, which was basically what the Paris Hilton video was, right? So the more I looked into it, the more I found that there's some incredible links between those two industries, military and pornography. Both of them are they're kind of the vanguards of new technology in very different ways. The military creates a lot of it, whereas the pornography industry usually jumps on the new technology early. And I don't know if that's equally as important as creating it in the first place, but it is still very important, because when you have new technology, when somebody creates a new technology, they need somebody to come along and use it and to experiment with it, or else they're just not going to have the funds to further develop it to the point where it's, ready for mass consumption. So that's the role that the pornography industry plays. They're the early adopters. So to bring the third prong of it into it, I was also, just coincidentally, also starting to get interested in food technology. And this was probably, I'd say, about, I don't know, 5 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, where I'd read a really great book called Fast Food Nation by Eric Schlosser. Mm. And there was a chapter in that book where he went to a chemical factory and he kind of did these blind taste tests of these different test tubes. And in each tube were different flavors of things. You know, one tube had strawberry flavor, another tube had banana flavor, another tube had like a fully packed cheeseburger. And he said that he couldn't tell the difference, you know, with his eyes closed, it tasted like the real thing. So that really got me interested in food technology. And the more I started delving into food technology, the more I found that, and this is, I think, probably surprising to most people, a lot of food technology comes out of the military as well, or is developed for the military. And that makes, it does actually make a lot of sense when you think about it, because militaries, armies, they have some of the most pressing needs or the biggest needs to have food that's, you know, doesn't spoil, that can be transported easily, that is lightweight, and that can be energy dense and that sort of stuff. So a lot of the food processing techniques over the past century really have come from trying to supply the military with food that doesn't break down and perish, and also to try to make it taste better. So in the end of it, at the end of a very long answer to a simple question, is I put all three of these things together, and I thought, well, isn't that interesting? Because if you think of these things, generally speaking, the military, the pornography, and essentially the fast food business. And when I say fast food, I'm not just talking about McDonald's, I'm also talking about food processing. When you think of these three industries, you generally don't tend to think of them in positive ways. You think these are negative forces in the world. But at the same time, the three of them are responsible for so much technological development that there's just an innumerable amount of positive developments that they've been responsible for as well.
Well, I did notice that those three industries really do cater to our most primal needs as well.
Yeah, exactly. I call them the shameful trinity of needs in the book, because they are, despite thousands of years of evolution, you know, we can't get over the fact that we tend to fight amongst each other. We tend to pursue sex above all other things, you know. you open up any newspaper and you see the latest sex scandal, whether it's a celebrity or a politician or whatever. When you know, thousands of years of evolution, you'd think they'd know better. And then with food, you know, food is the same situation. We've got obesity epidemics happening everywhere in the world. So these are three things that are kind of, these are three very driving fundamental forces of humanity.
Is it the case that they can innovate more quickly than other industries as well?
In some cases, yeah. And it's funny, too, because when we talk about military technological development, we're talking a lot about the U.S., because the U.S. is by far the biggest military spender in the world. I can't remember what the exact stats are, but the Pentagon spends something like more than, at least more than half of the total global spending on military. So they actually have this special agency. It's the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, which is, its goal is, it's almost like the that branch in the James Bond movies, you know, that Q's in charge of.
Right.
They're the ones who are charged with you know, looking into the really far out stuff. They're literally researching things like force fields, and I think they may even have a time travel project on the go. They just do all this wacky stuff. And I spoke to one of the directors or a former guy who used to work for DARPA. He's actually the guy who was very instrumental in creating the internet for DARPA back in the 70s. And one of the things he said was the great thing about the military when it comes to technology is that they generally don't have, they generally think long term. They don't always have short-term goals in mind like private companies do.
Right.
So, you know, a technology company today might think, well, we can't invest in that because we don't see where the payoff is. You know, we have to invest in stuff that's going to increase our profits and please our shareholders next quarter. So that's where the military is freed up to think long-term there. And as far as the pornography industry is concerned, they have they come from a very different direction too, which is that they're always in sort of a battle with courts and governments and regulatory bodies and that sort of thing. So this is part of one of the things I found really interesting in my research is that they tend to jump on new technologies because new technologies don't tend to be very regulated, governments and courts and whatnot. It usually takes them a while to catch up to new technologies. Like we're just seeing laws that are starting to affect the internet come into place now, and the internet's really only about 40 years old now. So the pornography companies like to jump on the new technologies because there's usually no laws or regulations or anything involving them. So that's one of the reasons why they go there.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking with Peter Nowak, freelance journalist, syndicated blogger, and best-selling author of the book Sex, Bombs, and Burgers, How War, Porn, and Fast Food Created Technology as We Know It. So let's start with food. Tell us how deliciously addictive fast food fries came to be.
Yeah, I've actually become a bit of a snob, a fry snob, in the few years since I started working on this book. It's just because there's so many different ways to create the fries. And I guess the fries really, the way they came to be was an interesting story too, because it was really McDonald's is kind of responsible for the current state of fries and potatoes, actually, the entire state of the potato industry in the world. Because what happened when the chain first started, I think it was back in the 50s, they didn't have a lot of restaurants, so they were serving fresh-cut potato fries. And the problem with this was they tasted great, but the problem was that they just couldn't handle volume. So there was a guy named Simplot, J.R. Simplot in Idaho, and he came up with this idea while he was working with the military, where he basically flash froze them. So what that is that you basically blast the fries with super cold air, and this freezes them in a matter of seconds. The problem with trying to freeze fries or freeze anything in the traditional manner, like if you put it in the freezer and just hope it freezes that way, is that when you then defrost it, the water molecules inside the food expand. And so that usually makes your food soggy, especially in the case of fries. So he came up with this process where if you flash freeze it, then the water molecules don't actually expand once you thaw them. And to make matters even better is if you fry them in cooking oil, then what happens is that the cooking oil enters the fry and basically replaces those water molecules, which is what it's terribly unhealthy, but it's also very tasty. So that's kind of the secret as to why fries taste so good. And so he, he brought this technique to the McDonald's CEO, and he basically took one bite and he said, "Oh, that's great." And that, the rest was history. And McDonald's ended up converting to frozen fries from there, and basically started the charge and started the trend.
And McDonald's was really on the forefront of technological advances, wasn't it? They really forced a lot of innovation.
It was, and it's actually surprising how much innovation McDonald's has led. Even things like rooftop air conditioning units on buildings, McDonald's was the first company to use those, and that's generally not something that's well known. McDonald's also hired a guy when they really started to expand in the 60s across the U.S. In earnest, the head entrepreneur here, Ray Kroc, he really wanted this idea of kind of like a plug-and-play kitchen. It was basically one kitchen that you could design and then just plop it into any McDonald's. And so he got a guy who actually designed kitchens for submarines, military submarines, to come in and do this. And because he figured that they would be basically operating under similar conditions, very cramped, had to be easy to clean. So this guy came in and he basically designed everything out of stainless steel, and it was all very compact, and you could remove one part and replace it with another, and that was that. And so that was kind of the first real industrial fast food kitchen. That is basically, this is sort of standard issue for many, many restaurants, not just fast food, but just across the food industry.
How about the mass spectrometer? What's the link between the military and food there?
This is something that it's a device that is almost unknown outside of the scientific field. Inside the scientific field, it's kind of, it's kind of like, it's almost taken for granted. It's just such a necessary instrument. And this it was basically invented in the early 1900s. And what it is it's a device that lets you take an element and essentially measure it for weight. So you can identify different elements and different isotopes of that element. So it's really, hardcore chemistry stuff that I can't pretend to understand. But what it does is it basically lets you take any sort of material and basically study it and break it down onto the atomic level. So, to give you an example, before there was a mass spectrometer, Coca-Cola, for example, was always secret or jealously guarding its secret recipe. But if you took a mass spectrometer and basically broke Coca-Cola apart, you could find out exactly what they were making it with. So the importance of this was it's used in every industry. It's used for example, if the Olympics uses it to test blood samples of athletes to see if they've been using steroids and that sort of stuff. But it's extremely essential to the food industry, for obvious reasons. And what it also allowed too was, this is actually sort of the plus side, depends on how you look at it, but as you had more food processing techniques coming out in the 1950s and in the 1960s, so things like like the French fries with the flash freezing, or when you had powdered coffees and that sort of stuff, all of these things were coming out of the war. A lot of these food processing techniques really stripped out a lot of flavor and a lot of vitamins from foods. So you some of the first processed foods in the 1950s were just terrible, terrible tasting. So once you were able to apply the mass spectrometer to these things, you could finally get into figuring out exactly why these things taste bad, and you could start to correct them. So the mass spectrometer, for good or for ill, actually led to the whole food additive, to the birth of the food additive business. So that's where you started getting artificial flavors, artificial colors, etc. So again, this is sort of it's almost kind of a negative development, but at the same time, it's hard to argue that we're not in a positive trend of, as people become more health conscious, they want better foods and they want healthier foods. So we're in this, to some extent, we're in this trend where a lot of these bad additives are slowly but surely being replaced by positive additives. I remember reading a story not too long ago about, I think it was out of Edmonton. Some of the scientists there were researching a way to use actual, organic bacteria and use them as food preservatives, which is really great, because I think, using organic bacteria that's actually harmless is a much better food additive than, say, using sodium. So, for good and for ill, the mass spectrometer effectively changed the food production system completely.
All of the sections that you wrote on food are intensely interesting, but I really have to talk about space food, because it's space food. And that led to an incredible number of innovations. Now, NASA began developing food that astronauts could eat in space in 1961 for the Apollo mission. So what kind of characteristics would space food have to be space food?
it's a good question. Space food, that's probably one of my favorite parts of the book too, because I actually did go down to Houston, down to NASA there, where they have their lab where they create all the food that the astronauts eat. And their chief food scientist actually served me up a plate of this stuff, and it was like there was ribs and there was beans and some other stuff as well, and most of it was quite tasty actually, and it was kind of surprising. Because I think we generally equate space food as being, this horrific, terribly frozen or freeze-dried stuff that you get, you know, you can get it at like museum gift shops. Which
are you talking about astronaut ice cream, the freeze-dried ice cream? I personally love that stuff. I am addicted.
Yeah, well,
so just you know, don't knock it.
It's an acquired taste, I think. Yeah, I was thinking about the strawberries, actually. That you can
right.
get, and those things are horrible. So, yeah, in any event, yes, so NASA is one of the biggest contributors to scientific and technological development that we've ever known. It's hard to overstate that, actually. I know that sounds like that sounds pretty exaggerative, but it's actually not. That NASA has produced so much positive technological stuff, and it's the list is huge. You know, stuff for like better tires for cars come from, you know, developing better tires for space shuttles. Even silly stuff like super soaker squirt guns, those were developed by NASA. I don't exactly know why, but they were developed by NASA. When it comes to food, I think it's probably safe to say that there, you know, generally you don't have, we don't, when you read the news, we generally don't have a lot of food epidemics or bad food breakouts. And a lot of this is because of NASA. I mean, comparatively speaking to, you know, developing countries where, I don't know if you've ever been to, say, Cuba or something, but if you go down there, you can, you never know if you're going to end up with food poisoning after a meal. So NASA developed, they were, because they'd have to feed these astronauts in space, and they really didn't know what the effects of space was going to be on the food. They developed these really, really stringent testing functions and testing systems. And they hired Pillsbury, who are the, you know, the people who are known for the doughboy, the giggling doughboy. And they basically told Pillsbury, okay, here's what we need, and here's the system that you have to basically abide by. So Pillsbury got very good at creating this food through a very stringent system, and the company decided afterwards, and this was for the moon race, they figured, well, why don't we just start applying this to our own you know, consumer food system? And eventually the whole system evolved and developed into something called Hazard Analysis and Critical Control Point System, or HACCP. And this is a system that was caught on, and pretty much every company, producer, farmer, manufacturer, anybody involved in the food production system eventually adopted this system as well, and not just in the U.S., but all across the world. So this is really a system that tests every aspect of food production, you know, from the farming of it to the transportation of it, to the processing of it, to the packaging of it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this is all, you know, stuff that we don't generally think about because we sort of take our food for granted. But this is again another example of food safety, extremely important food safety coming out of the space program.
We have a question from the audience from Carla.
Has fast food made any particular kinds of produce more genetically homogenous, like has happened with the banana?
Yeah, I think that's probably safe to assume. Because, you know, take McDonald's, for example. McDonald's has a very specific kind of potato that it requires for its fries. I think it's a brown russet, if I'm not mistaken. And so, obviously, if you're a potato farmer, and you're one of your biggest buyers is McDonald's, well, then you're going to grow more brown russet potatoes than any other kind of potatoes. McDonald's is the biggest buyer of potatoes in the world, not surprisingly, as well as beef, chicken, and is it pork? I'm not sure if they're the biggest pork buyer, but they're the second biggest buyer of chicken, next to KFC, I believe. So, yeah, fast food absolutely has a very homogenizing effect on the kinds of foods that are grown.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking, and I'll be right back with more of Peter Nowak, author of Sex, Bombs, and Burgers, after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at the intersection between science and playtime. Guest host Julieta de los Santos talks to Dr. Jane Gackenbach and T. Snyder about their book, Play Reality: How Video Games Are Changing Everything. And we listen back to The Petri Dish, a panel discussion by kids for kids and their parents about getting kids interested in science, recorded live at LogicCon 2012. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm here today with Peter Nowak, best-selling Toronto author who is here to talk about his book, Sex, Bombs, and Burgers, How War, Porn, and Fast Food Created Technology as We Know It. Now, I think that most people understand that there's a link between gaming and the military because many training simulations are just, in effect, big video games. But people might not be aware of the deeper connection. You wrote that the first video game was initially developed by a gentleman who worked on the Manhattan Project?
Yeah, his name was William Higginbotham, and he was basically an electrical engineer. And so he created a lot of instrumentation stuff, gauges and that sort of thing to measure how the bomb was going to explode. And it's kind of interesting because he ended up, I think, becoming well known for creating the video game. But that he died. I think it was in the 80s that he passed away, and I think that probably would have upset him because he really spent a good part of his life trying to fight against nuclear proliferation. So once he saw the atomic bomb explode, he was just, like a lot of the scientists who worked on it, he was horrified. So he tried to, he started an organization of American scientists to try to, argue for why these bombs shouldn't be used and that sort of stuff. So in any event, after the war, he went to work at Brookhaven National Lab on Long Island. And so he was working in instrumentation there, and they decided that this, again, this lab was also working on it was part of the nuclear arsenal program, and so they were trying to, they decided that they needed to brush up their image with local residents, so they decided to have these open house sessions where people could come in and see everything that they were working on at this lab, and you know, kind of feel safer about this lab being there and that it wasn't going to blow them all to hell and that sort of stuff. So William thought, well, you know, all this stuff is, what are these people going to come here and see? They're going to see, you know, dials and buttons and you know, giant mainframe computers, which are not exciting to anybody. So he thought, well, why not create some sort of example or some sort of exhibit of a digital computer, an actual computer, of what it could do. So what he did was he hooked up this system where it was basically an analog computer, and he hooked it up to an oscilloscope, which is, it's one of those, you've probably seen them, but they're kind of hard to explain. They're kind of like a box, and they've got a circular little window, and they're usually used to measure voltage. So you'll see, like, you know, a green line, almost like one of those hospital monitors. And so he took one of those things, hooked it up to an analog computer, and then he hooked up he jury-rigged these sort of handheld controllers. They had little paddles on them. And so he created this game, and it called it Tennis for Two. And basically what it was is it kind of was like a horizontal view of a tennis field or pitch or whatever they're called, where it was just a green horizontal line and then a little vertical line in the middle. And this ball that was bouncing up over that vertical line back and forth. And two players could control where the ball was going with their little paddles. So this was basically the first video game ever created. And so people came and saw it, and they thought it was great. And they showed it the following year as well, and people liked it too. They added some little tweaks to it, like they said, well, we can adjust it so that we can demonstrate what the gravity is on Mars, so you could play tennis on Mars, where the ball is much heavier or lighter. I can't remember what you are on Mars. But anyways, so that was essentially the first video game. But after that, they dismantled it and pretty much did nothing with it. So they didn't go anywhere with that video game until it was the 1970s, I think it was, or the late 60s, 1970s, when a guy named Ralph Baer, he was working for a company in New England called Sanders Associates, and this was a military contractor. And he kind of had the same sort of curiosity or same desire to do something different. He was, before he'd worked at a defense contractor, he'd worked at a television company. And he was kind of convinced that you could do something more with television sets than just use them to watch television programs. So he kind of created the system where it was similar to Tennis for Two, but it was basically, he created these handheld controllers hooked up to a computer, and then on the screen you would have these little tiny little points of light, pinpoints of light, and players could control these lights, and they could chase each other around the screen, which by today's standards sounds like the worst video game ever. But this was kind of, there's a dispute over exactly who had the first video game, but this was kind of the first game that led to what we now know as the video game industry, because Ralph managed to convince his bosses to give him some funding and you know, take this idea further. So eventually he created something called the Brown Box, and which was the first ever video game console. And so Sanders, they tried to license it to different television makers. Nobody would really bite. And they finally got a taker in a company known as Magnavox. And Magnavox, in, I think it was 1972, released the Magnavox Odyssey, which that was the first commercially available video game console. And, you know, it had sort of these kind of really primitive games where there was some, you know, kind of chasing people around the screen type of games, sort of like what Ralph had created. And it didn't really sell very well because people were confused. They thought that you needed actual Magnavox television for this thing to work with it. And not many people had Magnavox televisions, apparently. But in any event, I think it was a year later, a year or two later, or a couple years after that, Atari finally put it all together, and they came out with the Atari 2600, which was a very successful video game console. And from there, you know, the rest is history. As they say, the video game industry is now, I think it's projected to be something like $80 billion in the next few years. So from humble military beginnings, it came.
Now, there's a ton you talked about in your book. Roomba's military connection and prosthetic limbs, and there is so much, but I really do want to mention the internet because it deserves a shout-out, really. And it came directly from the military, correct?
Yeah, the military. So, again, going back to what we were talking about earlier, DARPA, it was actually known as ARPA at the time. They added the D later. This was this agency that was created after the Russians launched Sputnik. So NASA and ARPA/DARPA were actually both created right after Sputnik was launched, because that was a huge technological embarrassment to the United States. After the World War II ended, the U.S. was basically riding high, and they were like, wow, like, we're the technological kings of the world, we've got everything going for us. Meanwhile, the Russians beat them to space, so they were very ashamed of that. So they created these two agencies to ensure that would never happen again. So ARPA, they'd basically taken part in a lot of these crazy projects that resulted in things like satellites and rockets to the moon and et cetera, et cetera. So one of the things they wanted to do was, they were a little concerned about what would happen if nuclear weapons were to hit the U.S., and they wanted to basically create a communication system that would survive such an attack. And the way the communications was set up in those days, basically in the 60s, prior to the 60s, was it was very centralized. So if you took out one location, you could pretty much bring down the entire system. So ARPA was in the midst of creating the system that was decentralized, that had many different nodes, so that if you took, you know, if you took out one part, the rest would continue to function. And so this was basically how it all came to be. And a fellow by the name of Vint Cerf, he was a Stanford professor at the time, and he was hired to basically try to come up with a language that all of these different nodes could speak, so that they would understand each other. And so he came up with this thing. It's very technical. It's called the TCP/IP, which is, I can't remember what it stands for, but it's Transmission Protocol or whatever. And this is essentially the language that the internet still works on. And so they basically rolled this out in the early 70s. And one of the first images that they transmitted over this thing was, this is a funny link to the whole pornography industry, is some of the researchers that were working on this thing down at the University of Southern California, they were working with early scanners, and they were digitizing images, and they were really bored of them. These were basically a lot of young guys working on this, and they were all bored of their, you know, pictures of trees and whatnot. So they said, well, let's get a human face in here. So they sent somebody out, and of course the guy came back with a Playboy magazine, and they scanned the centerfold, and they kind of cut, you know, the naughty parts. So it was just basically the head and shoulders of this model, and they scanned it, and then they sent it around, and this image became it was known as the Lena, L-E-N-A, Lena. She was a Swedish model. It sort of became this urban legend where it kind of drifted off into nobody. Eventually, her origins were forgotten, so nobody really knew that this was a Playboy centerfold that was circulating, but everybody knew who it was. And it was funny because when I spoke to Vint at one point while I was working on this book, Vint Cerf, and I showed him a picture I showed him the picture, and he said, "Oh, it's Lena." But he had actually no idea that she was a Playboy model. So it was really funny. This is a guy who was working for the military at the time, designing the internet, knew exactly what this picture was, but had no idea where it had come from. So this is one of the first big images that really basically brought a graphical element to the internet.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with Peter Nowak, author of Sex, Bombs, and Burgers, How War, Porn, and Fast Food Created Technology as We Know It. Well, since you're talking about porn anyway, we might as well move to that. Now, you say in your book that porn perfected the internet. Do tell.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, so the internet, the way it developed after that, this was really in about 1982, if I'm not mistaken, where the government allowed commercial companies to connect their own systems to what was known as the ARPANET, which was the military internet. And one of the first company I think that did this was MCI, which was interesting because Vint Cerf, the guy who had created this whole language that the internet worked on, he went off into worked for private companies. So he was working at MCI, and there he helped them build basically this internal email system. So the internet, some people consider its true birth, its real birth date is kind of hard to pinpoint, but many people consider it when MCI connected its email system to these to the ARPANET. So that was what became the internet. And that was in the early 80s. Now the actual internet itself didn't really start to take off until the late 80s or so, when first in the form of chat rooms and news groups. And the most popular of these news groups and chat rooms, it's not at all surprising to anyone now, was of course the ones that were sex related. So I think the stats were something like in 1990, something like the top four or five Usenet groups were, of course, sex or pornography related. And this is where people would either chat about sex, or they would upload images. You know, many of them were, as we're learning today, many of them were copyright violated. So they would be taking Playboy images and scanning them and then uploading them online.
Mm-hmm.
So it's clear that that's where the early demand was. And again, this is another example of when you have a technology, it's usually in its early phases, it goes through this process where pornography still makes up a very large portion of the current internet, but it's much, much smaller than it was back in the early days, in the late 80s, early 90s. I don't know what that says about human nature, but that's just the way things work. So now the people who actually produced this stuff, produced the pornography, they saw this going on and they thought, hey, this is fantastic. This is we should jump on this and we should take advantage of this. So that's where all of this stuff sprung up. So Playboy, for example, Playboy says it was the first national magazine to actually have a website. A lot of the porno magazines, they were quick to launch their own websites because they figured, well, if people are stealing our stuff or getting our stuff for free, we should try to give it to them in a way where we can actually make some money, which is still a situation that's going on today. Then there was other examples too. I spoke to one guy in the book. He was the head of IT for a major multinational bank, and he told me that this was in the early 2000s, where they were having this discussion, internal discussion, where they were trying to, they thought, wouldn't it be great if we could send out this, you know, this sort of stock advice tip sheet to our investors or to our share, you know, to our investors every morning. And wouldn't it be great if we could do this in some sort of video format? But this was prior to YouTube, so there was no real commercial way to do this. So what they did was they basically took one of their interns and they gave him a credit card and they sent him home and they said, okay, go scout out all these porn sites and see how they do it and report back. So the intern came back and you know, a couple weeks later, and he said, okay, here you go. And he had basically built exactly what they were looking for, and he had basically just ripped off the technology that the porn companies were using to do this. So this was a major bank. I can't say which one, unfortunately, but that's how it goes. So that the porn companies were delving into video well before YouTube came along, and then, of course, ever since.
I really have to talk about the porn site bots, because I had no idea that they were nearly intelligent enough to pass the Turing test.
Yeah, the most famous example was a few years ago. It was a Russian, well, it's believed that it was created by Russian hackers called CyberLover. And this thing, I actually just wrote a story about this. I was actually fooled by this thing, I was fooled by a precursor of this thing myself a few years ago when I was living in New Zealand. I don't know if anybody remembers the Friendster website, but it was kind of the, I think it might have even been a precursor to MySpace, but it was a social network, and there was, turned out that there was a bot that was circulating on this website, and it was pretty smart, because what it would do was it would go to people's profiles and glean details from that profile, like where you were from, what your interests were, what your job was, and then it would send you messages that incorporated those things. So, you know, I got this message from somebody, and I thought, well, this is a real person. And, you know, we had a few emails back and forth, and I couldn't tell. And, you know, I was here, I'm a techno nerd, so I should be vigilant for this stuff, right? Now, of course, I figured it out when eventually this person sent me a link to, or I said, well, can I see more details about yourself? And they sent me a link to this website, and I went to the website, and you had to pay to get into the website. And I thought, okay, well, this is clearly some sort of ruse. So I think it was about a year or two later where the CyberLover program came along. It was also known as the SlutBot. And this thing was apparently making the sites on Russian dating sites, and it was able to, you know, sustain conversations and basically fool people into doing the same thing. And that was, you know, divulging either their personal information or their financial information. So there's a lot of these chatbots around on the internet. There's one, if you do a search on Captain Kirk chatbot, it's a pretty funny one. You can go to this website where it's Captain Kirk from Star Trek, and he'll actually have a conversation with you. And there's, you know, there's an animation of his face too. So it's kind of funny. But what's happening is that basically there's two kinds of people who are working on artificial intelligence. And the first kind, they're either somehow doing it for the military, or the military sponsoring it. I think the estimates are something that 80% of all artificial intelligence funding is coming from the military. And the rest is criminals who are also turning to things like chatbots as an effort to, you know, get people's information, because it's becoming harder for them to use traditional things like spam or phishing attacks, etc. So, you know, we're getting things like things popping up on Facebook and Twitter, where you get this message from somebody who is one of your friends and you think you trust, and this person saying, "Wow, did you see this photo of you?" And then there's a link, and you click on it, and then you're doomed. Your computer's infected, etc. So that's one way that it's happening. But the whole sexual side of it, that's a really easy way for them to do it, because when people are starting to think in terms of, you know, when they're starting to think with maybe not their primary head, they get a little stupider.
That was succinct. I'm going to try to get to some audience questions in here. This one is from Lawrence.
Is it true that adult video producers had an influence on the competition between the Blu-ray and HD DVD video standards?
Yeah, I've wondered that one too, because I think it's generally accepted that they had a very significant impact on the whole VHS versus beta, and that was for a number of reasons. One is that VHS had a longer running time. Two, I think it was Sony that was behind beta. They wouldn't license beta, or they wouldn't allow beta to be used by porn companies. And so it's interesting because you fast forward to this other format war between Blu-ray and HD DVD. It was kind of the same situation where Sony wasn't allowing, at least initially, it wasn't allowing porn companies to use Blu-ray, the standard. But, of course, Blu-ray won out. So I'm not sure how much of an impact there was on that. I don't know if the real story of how Blu-ray won over HD DVD has been told yet. To me, there's something fishy about how it all came to be, but I don't know exactly what happened there. My suspicion is that I don't think the adult business had much to do with that, because they were supporting HD DVD, and if their influence was that strong, then that format, I think, would have won out.
This is a question from John.
Do you believe that technology has value that's completely independent of its origin? Or is there a moral taint on a technology that's created for a horrible purpose?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And a lot of the scientists I talked to, we talked about that very topic. And the sense I get from scientists, and of course this is a generalization, but a lot of scientists are very much engrossed in what it is they're doing. And in some ways, if I think it's a bit of a criticism of scientists in general, and again, I'm generalizing here, is that sometimes they can't see the forest for the trees, to use that cliche, and that is that they can't necessarily see how their technology is going to be used, but they still need to do it anyways. So, a good example is, well, the atomic bomb is of course, an example, because you have to ask yourself, well, how could these guys have been working on this stuff without having any, idea of how it was going to turn out? And then when they actually saw the thing explode, they were all horrified, and they said, I think it was Oppenheimer, I think he said something like, we're all bastards now, once he saw the explosion. So in a similar way, too, when you talk to a lot of scientists and you say, hey, do you think... you might talk to a neuroscientist, for example, and say, hey, do you think we'll ever have the brain digitized and we'll be able to completely replicate a person's personality in a computer and then implant that into a robot, and, you've basically got a clone? I think most neuroscientists will say, no, you're crazy, that'll never happen. But I think that's because they don't see a lot of what's going on outside of their field either. So, every time something comes along, There's always doubt. The best example is the Human Genome Project, which started, I think it was in the early 90s. And I think it was 5 years into that program, they had something like 1 or 2% of the genome mapped. And a lot of the scientists that were working on it said, we're never going to finish this. But lo and behold, within a decade, they had everything done. It was done. They finished well ahead of what they thought they were going to do, and that's because they didn't take into account all the advances to things like computer processing speeds, the internet, the ability to spread information amongst different nodes and that sort of stuff, and things like cloud computing, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a long answer to a short question, but yes, I think that scientists sometimes have blinders on.
We are very, very unfortunately out of time. But Peter, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, no problem. It was my pleasure.
You can find the link to Peter Nowak, the author of Sex, Bombs, and Burgers, How War, Porn, and Fast Food Created Technology as We Know It, on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, you are very much encouraged to click the links to Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, so that you can keep current on show news, and to iTunes, where you can download an episode or subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells, cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending.
mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. You're